also the factions of the resistance, but in specific Hezbollah. It is obvious that the Israeli rhetoric never ceased against the Islamic resistance in Lebanon. However, it took a different form this year after four different Arab regimes normalized with the Israeli entity. What steps will Hezbollah be taking to maybe pick up Martyr Soleimani's cause, his ideals, and his vision for a free Palestine?
الذي جمعنا بالشهيد قاسم سليماني هو إيماننا وقناعتنا أن فلسطين.
What brought us together with the martyr Qasem Soleimani was our faith and our conviction that Palestine and Al-Quds must be liberated. We and him were in a soul march because we all were believing in one conviction. Therefore, after his martyrdom, this belief will not change, and we think it must carry on. On the contrary, due to his martyrdom, we should be more loyal to him and other martyrs in order to achieve the goals they work for. Here, Israel has been threatening Lebanon and Palestine and all the region. We do not base our confrontation with Israel on threats, but rather on the conviction that we must liberate our land and liberate Palestine. These threats in the aftermath of Qasem Soleimani's martyrdom have been the weakest during Israeli entity's history because they are hollow drums. And the Israelis know very well that Hezbollah's resistance is ready on a high scale of capabilities and preparations. Therefore, they really are fully aware that should they execute their threats in attacking us in Lebanon, we shall respond harsher than they expect in a way that it can't be compared to previous fighting periods. Israel knows quite well that the development of circumstances have not changed our will in fighting and defending. It is true, we do not have a decision to take confrontations initiative from Lebanon, but we do have a ready decision to defend whatever the regional political circumstances are. The world and Israel know, to the extent that when Israel conducted a military drill that tilted confronting the Golan, Palestine and Lebanon, we went into alert mode in preparation for an imminent battle. The Israelis knew that. What I mean is that Israelis' threats do not constitute any danger to us. Yes, they might spread some alert and make us prepare better, but they will not alter the equation. We are ready and shall respond should Israel
attack.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani gave his life not only to protect his family or his government or his nation, he actually gave his life to protect all the region's nations, especially those fighting against Western hegemony and Western aggression. Now, the empire murdered him because they knew that he united all the forces against this Western imperial power in the region. However, the empire works on disintegrating each faction by itself with different weapons, meaning it sometimes uses war with some resistance, sometimes uses terrorism with others, and with the likes of Lebanon and Iran, they use sanctions. How much longer do you think the resistance factions in this region can take this much hit?
لا يوجد خيار أمام دول محور المقاومة.
Countries of the Axis of Resistance and their fighters do not have any alternative but to withstand, resist, and remain in the battlefields in full alert because it is expected from our enemy to attack in various forms. They might be political, military, cultural, or economic. It is true that Americans have different approaches in each of the countries that belong to the Axis of Resistance. For instance, you're a war, but another country, a proxy war, here by Israel and there by Saudi Arabia, and finally through sanctions in another state. But at the end of the day, these mobile wars in different forms are classified as an aggression against resistance axis as a whole. And no doubt, this axis will suffer. Therefore, all states in the resistance movement must defend themselves, because any success will be credited to the states and resistance factions. At the top of them is the Islamic Republic of Iran. When we confronted the Israeli enemy in 2006 and defeated it, that wasn't for Lebanon only, but for Palestine, Syria, Iran, Iraq, and everybody in the region.
One last word that you would say to the nations in West Asia that felt a huge loss with the martyrdom of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and his companions like the Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the Deputy Director of the Popular Mobilization Forces of Iraq. What would you tell them for them to have more patience when it comes to handling a force like that coming from the West?
أقول لشعوب المنطقة ما قاله تعالى عند وفاة رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله.
I repeat to the regional nations what Almighty God said when the Prophet of Islam passed away. Muhammad is no more than a messenger. And indeed, messengers have passed away before him. If he dies or is killed, will you then turn back on your heels? And he who turns back on his heels, not the least harm will he do to Allah, and Allah will give reward to those who are grateful. We are grateful. The regional nations are grateful as well. They will pass this test. And this affliction is an inseparable chunk of the strength of the march and its future. There is no way to win glory and great standing unless there are sacrifices. We are pleased that this great sacrifice was given by the martyr Qasem Soleimani. Therefore, as a result of it, the spirit of jihad ignited more in the region. We haven't seen or heard people talking about any retreat or withdrawal, but the renewal of allegiance and determination to confrontation. Look at the other side. The martyr Qasem Soleimani accelerated by his martyrdom the withdrawal of American troops from Iraq. He paved the way for establishing a greater turn of the axis of resistance after his martyrdom and unleashed resistance units to express their views clearly that neither Israel nor America shall be victorious.
Deputy Secretary General of the Lebanese Islamic Resistance, Hezbollah, Sheikh Naim Qasem, thank you for your time and your contribution for the commemorating of the first anniversary of the martyrdom of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and the Deputy Director of the Popular Mobilization Forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, and their companions. Thank you very much, and thank you. We'll see you soon again.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Warm water tap. Well, it's very hot. And this is the cold water tap. Oh, thank God. You know, my bathroom plumbing was out of service today, and I just had it repaired. In the past, very long time ago, when most Iranian homes didn't have a bath, there was a public bathhouse in every corner of the city, which was called Garmabe, meaning a place where there is warm water. Most of such old bathhouses are architectural masterpieces. Today I'm going to visit one of these old bathhouses, to Nawab Bathhouse.
Nawab Bathhouse is located in one of the oldest districts of Tehran in Ray Street. Nawab Bathhouse has been restructured and repaired several times. This bathhouse welcomes the tourists who are interested in the old historical texture of the city of Tehran. Nawab Bathhouse is one of the monuments remained from the Qajarid era. During the Qajarid era, Tehran used to have 182 bathhouses, which most of them no longer exist. People in the past, whether in Iran or other parts of the world, used to hang out in bazaars, bathhouses, or coffee houses. These places used to be a point for social, cultural, and economic interactions. And that's why the architecture of these places were paid special attention to. The architecture of Nawab Bathhouse has really beautiful tile work and drawings. I am passing through the winding alleys of Ray Street. I'm looking for Baik Damghani Alley. Aha! I found it. Here it is. Okay, and this is the building I was looking for. An old but very attractive brick building. On top of the entrance, there is a beautiful tile work which has a writing on it which reads, "The Nawab Bathhouse." I have to go down a few stairs. In the past, bathhouses were built on a floor that was lower than the earth's level, so that the heat in the bathhouse would be kept and water sources like canals and springs would be used in an optimal way. The vestibule of Nawab Bathhouse. Vestibule, or as we call it in Persian, Hashti, is a covered atmosphere which connects the entrance gate to the bathhouse. Oh, what a magnificent ceiling! This is a dome-like ceiling which its bricks are arranged in a charming way. Sarbine of Nawab Bathhouse. Sarbine is the bathhouse's changing room. Just around the room, there are wooden lockers in which people can keep their stuff. Oh well, here is Garmkhane, a place people used to make the water hot. This place is adorned with big turquoise-colored tiles, as well as a line of navy blue tiles. To reach the main bath, I have to go down a few stairs. Oh, wow! This is really beautiful. There is a pool in the middle. It's a big pool with cold water inside, which people used to float in so that they got cool. You know, bathhouses of those times were really hot, and the presence of such cool water pool would be more enjoyable. Well, now let's go to the bathhouse's roof. I am now at the roof of the bathhouse. What I'm seeing is incredible. There are several brick domes here. On some of the smaller domes, there are colorful glasses. These glasses supply the light of the bathhouse and have created a pretty and colorful atmosphere for the bathhouse. The splendor of the Nawab bathhouse is indescribable. Visit this historical place to see its beauties from a closer view. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, January 3rd marks the first anniversary of the U.S.'s terrorist assassination of Iran's General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, along with their companions. These were the ultimate anti-terror commanders in the world. They fought against those terrorists who were threatening humanity with beheadings, crucifixions, and killings in mass. General Soleimani devised the military strategy which caused their defeat in the region. So why did the U.S. kill them, and why hasn't the United Nations made Washington pay for its crime?
Iran's anti-terrorism icon was assassinated by the United States military in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, on January the 3rd. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was the highest-ranking commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Soleimani played a key role in strengthening resistance movements across the region. The commander took part in different battlefields to lead resistance fighters. A quiet, charismatic man, a strategic genius, and a tactical operator who spent most of his life in combat. Soleimani first set foot on a battlefield in the 1980s when the newly founded Islamic Republic of Iran came under attack by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Soleimani was at the time a young man in his 20s fighting tirelessly to defend Iranian soil against the aggressor. After 8 years of war, Soleimani emerged battle-tested and battle-hardened. He became a national hero and a beloved commander in the IRGC. Soleimani and the forces under his command soon became one of the instrumental players in combating terrorism in Iran's southeastern areas and in Afghanistan. But the most important chapter of his military career started when he became the chief commander of the IRGC's Quds Force in 1998. General Soleimani strongly supported the Palestinian cause. He spared no effort to strengthen the Hezbollah resistance movement in Lebanon. During the 33-day war between Israel and Lebanese resistance fighters in 2006, General Soleimani went to Lebanon to oversee the battle against the Israeli regime. The fight against the Daesh terrorist group probably marked the climax of his anti-terror endeavors. During the tough campaign against Daesh, he was often seen in battlefields in Iraq and Syria. General Soleimani was the brain behind key operations that paralyzed the monster terror group and rolled back its advances. Soleimani has long been a household name in Iran and many regional countries. His presence in the battle against terrorism gave people a sense of security. It is no doubt tough for them to deal with his loss. People in Iraq and Iran are still mourning the loss of their anti-terror icon. Soleimani's funeral processions have become a symbol of unity. Following the US assassination, regional resistance groups pledged to remain steadfast on his path. The general is no longer among us, but his martyrdom seems to have given fresh blood to the resistance front.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, the founder of Al Qayyim Seminary out of Qom, Mehdi Taib, and from the Islamic Human Rights Commission out of London, Reza Kazem. Welcome both of you to the program. Well, let me start it off with Mehdi in Qom. The U.S. had said that it was fighting against terrorism, and yet Donald Trump admitted that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton created Daesh. So which is it? Does the U.S. support terrorism, or is it that the U.S. is actually the leading terrorist under the guise of fighting against it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's good to be with you guys again. Good evening, Marzia.
Good evening. Thanks for coming.
Well, it's known for the people of the world that the main supporter of terrorism today is the system of the United States of America and the allies of the United States. The United States today is the symbol of imperialism, and especially and specifically the people of this region, they know that. They know that they've come all the way from America to this region to take over the resources of this region, and they do anything and everything or anything else, they do everything in their power to take control of the resources of this region and to divide the people of this region and conquer, and also to safeguard the existence of the of Israel. So it's a joke to come and assassinate someone who's been fighting terrorism his whole life under the name of freedom, under the name of fighting with terrorism, someone who's known for fighting against terrorism, and the people of this region love him dearly. What the United States of America did under the administration of Trump, by the order of Trump, was not something that the people of this region nor the people of the world can accept, and they didn't accept it. Mm-hmm. You saw what happened after the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani in Iran, not only in Iran, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Pakistan, basically in this region, and how people expressed their solidarity and their love for General Qasem Soleimani all around the globe. So this joke of fighting against terrorism that Trump and his administration or presidents before him, like Obama, say, it's a lie, and people know it's a lie, and they're the main supporters of terrorism
okay.
in this and all around the globe.
Okay. Well, Raza, what do you think the U.S. wanted to accomplish by killing General Soleimani, and what have they accomplished?
I think we need to understand that there is a lot of arrogance that exists within the attitude of the United States. It feels that it can do anything and get away with it, because to a large extent, over the 20th century, one of the things that has marked it is the number of places that America has intervened, invaded, etc., etc. The previous guest talked about the imperialism and the American imperialism that existed, and that's something that it has got. What has happened here is that it has been told no. It has been stood up to. It has been fought against. The agendas have been fought against. It has been directly attacked here. It has been directly targeted in many ways. And it felt that at this point in time, in all the arrogance, and while it was Trump that made this particular decision here, we need to understand it's not about just Trump. Every president that I've read about in the United States has been repulsive. And in terms of his actions with regards to the situations that have gone on and its imperialism and so on, leave alone its own domestic policy. So we need to understand that this has been an action of arrogance, that it felt that it could do this and it could get away with it. It felt that it was there was a kind of thing, because its agendas of promoting Daesh, ISIS in the region had failed. Its ability to be able to have the kind of influence that it wanted, not just influence, it was more than influence, the hegemony that was required by Washington in terms of complete control of the land, the resources, the minds of the people, was something that is it's incomprehensible and it's unacceptable to the United States regime to be able to get that. And with something that was embodied in Qasem Soleimani was that spirit of resisting everything that America stood for in its oppression against the people of the region. So I think, and the other thing that it wanted to try and do was cement the concept of promoting division between Arabs and the old Arab-Persian thing, the Iranian-Arab thing, and trying to promote that. And it was hoping that fomenting that kind of division within Iraqi society and within there, that they had succeeded, and therefore they would cement this by targeting. That's one aspect of it. And it singularly failed because there was such a huge reaction to this that I think no one would dare to stand up to remember Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Muhaddis in that region, mm-hmm. and in terms of what they'd actually achieved.
Right. Interesting what you've just said. Interesting what you've just said, Reza, because actually, turning to Mehdi, we just finished listening to a speech by Sheikh Qaisal Khazali in Iraq, and he says, as a matter of fact, one of their goals was exactly what Reza was saying, trying to divide Iranians and Iraqis. And as a matter of fact, with the assassination, with the killing of General Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis together, that they were actually brought together eternally, he says. Even parts of each other's bodies were buried in the other country, that it has actually cemented the unity and the brotherhood of Iranians and Iraqis. Your take.
Well, you beautifully stated that what happened made the two nations more united. They have been planting the seeds of discord between the two nations over the last decades. They've been trying to divide the people under different concepts, nationality or race or different things. That Iranians and Persians dislike Arabs, or Arabs dislike Iranians and Persians. But what happened in this assassination, which was based on a miscalculation again from the administration of the United States caused a unity, a stronger unity between Iranians and Iraqis, between Iranians and Lebanese, between Iranians and other nations. So right now what we have is what the leader of the Islamic Republic and other leaders of the resistance said, that the blood of Soleimani is far more dangerous than Soleimani himself. The blood of Soleimani has united the people of Iran within Iran. The blood of Soleimani has united the people of this region. The blood of Soleimani has empowered the resistance line. The blood of Soleimani is far more powerful than Soleimani himself. And let's not forget that Soleimani was just a commander, a general. Soleimani comes from a school that has been taught by the teachings of Imam Khomeini, by the true teachings of Islam. And by the assassination of one general, this path, this school, won't be stopped, and it will grow as a beautiful quote that Imam Khomeini says, that kill us, our nation will wake up, and these bloods that are on your hands will wake the people and will make our eyes open. This is the beauty of the concept of martyrdom. Qasem Soleimani was fighting ISIS, was fighting imperialism, was fighting terrorism and Zionism in this region, mm-hmm. but he wasn't alone. You see how he predicted the existence of Daesh maybe a year or a couple of months before they attacked different countries. It wasn't Qasem Soleimani alone, it was Qasem Soleimani's team. Qasem Soleimani managed to train different people, different soldiers, just like himself.
Okay.
And he wasn't...
Okay, yeah. stay with me, Matthew. Sorry, let me get Reza back in on this discussion. Well, Reza, other leaders of the resistance, such as Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, and also the head of Ansarullah, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, have both stated that one of the main reasons that General Soleimani was targeted was because he not only stood against the hegemon of the United States, but also the anti-Zionist, anti-Israel stance and pro-Palestinian policy. I'd like you to talk about that side of things.
I think that's absolutely clear. There's no arguing with that. That's something that was there. And I think it is, they'll do well to actually remember that when Mohsin Hujjaji was killed by ISIS in the way that he was, Qasem Soleimani promised that ISIS will be cleared and all of that region will be cleared of any kind of concept of a physical Islamic caliphate, as they'd termed it in that way. And that promise was achieved. And what we see in this particular thing, that the people of Palestine themselves have said that he is the Shaheed al-Quds, the martyr of Quds. And I think it's said for a reason. The structure, the infrastructure that Qasem Soleimani, along with Imad Mughniyya, had actually created within Palestine, in terms of the tunnels, in terms of the provisions, in terms of the arms, in terms of the training, and so on and so forth, are something that are going to last for a very long time. You cannot take away the training, you cannot take away some of those things, that lessons that have actually been learnt by the Palestinians in terms of making sure that they have the ability to resist and resist effectively in terms of an armed resistance. And I think that's something that needs to be understood, that he was someone who was out there and going into Gaza. You know, who would have thought it? Unless it had actually been said, I think most people who were actually supportive of the resistance would not necessarily have imagined that this is something that could have actually happened. Who are talking from the outside. And I think we need to understand that this individual and the infrastructure that he created, that fearlessness, you know, going into the battlefield in the way that he does, there are so many clips of him being, when there is even under fire and so on and so forth, that he's there. That creates a level of prowess and a level of resistance, a level of confidence that people on the front line will have that these people are not coming from the, you know, for example, sending troops to die, like what happens in Western establishments, that this person, the commander, is actually standing on the front line and doing what needs to be done. So even the enemies, when you look at their documentaries, are amazed by what he is as an individual, regardless of whether they agree with his ideology or not. And I think that combination of spirituality and so on, and that infrastructure with regards to Palestine that had actually been created by him and nurtured and nourished over a number of years before he came out of the shadows and came out into the open, this was something that has been, there's a reason why they don't like him in the British government and the American government. And I think that's something that needs to be understood, that, you know, when you stand against the imperial, the Zionist colony that still exists here in that region, it's something that will be something that is going to be problematic for them.
What about that, Mehdi? Isn't dealing with what Reza just said about dealing with Zionists, because General Soleimani also, do you not think that prove that the Zionists are not invincible as they like to project themselves, nor are the Americans exceptional? Your take on that?
Well, what the Americans are trying to do is that to show a strong image to people through the power of their propaganda and Hollywood, that, okay, we're the number one in the world and no one can defeat us. And Israel is also a power that no one can defeat. But the reality is, Qasem Soleimani, General Qasem Soleimani, and the leaders of the resistance, because they're dealing with the American army and Israeli army here, they knew the reality of who they are and the reality of their power. So they were accurate in their estimations, they're accurate in their information, and they knew the American army and Israeli army are very weak, and they're not what Hollywood and their propaganda is showing to people.
Okay,
so,
I'm sorry to cut you off, Mehdi, but I only have 1 minute left. I want to throw it back to Reza. Now, Reza, what all of the resistance leaders that we've heard speeches from, Yemen to Iraq to Lebanon today, all of them saying, reiterating, that American forces must leave the region, and they're not going to accept anything but that. Your take.
I think one other point I'll quickly make before I address that particular point is regarding the role of G4S, and we've seen some of the highlights in terms of identifying that G4S played in the Iraqi airport and the way that it was actually conducted. And I think it's not just about removing the American presence, it's also about looking at the detail of some of these security companies that exist and target and making sure that they're removed from Iraqi soil and Iraqi security infrastructure, because they're the ones that are part of the problem rather than part of the solution. The other aspect, in terms of the devastating vengeance that has been promised, America needs to decide what it's going to do, which way it's going to go out. You know, are they going to go back in body bags, or are they going to go back, in terms of the way that they are? You know, at the moment, that devastating vengeance has been promised. The Iranians went ballistic, and they classified that as a slap. So we need to understand that when they really are going to be, causing problems, that there are going to be lots of issues, both within Iraq and outside of Iraq and in the region, if the Americans continue to stay. It's something that's been stated right across by all of the resistance movements, and I think that's something that's inevitable.
And on that note, so sorry, Reza, I'm so sorry, but we are straight out of time. I appreciate both of you being with us, Mehdi Taib out of Qom, from the founder of the Al-Qayyim Seminary, and Reza Kazem from the Islamic Human Rights Commission out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
The U.S. Congress quietly wedged the billions of dollars of aid to the regime of Israel, even as it debated for months over a measly $600 to help Americans endure the COVID downturn, says Ramzi Barud, a journalist, in an article titled "The American Money Tree: The Untold Story of U.S. Aid to Israeli Regime." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. On December 21st, the United States Congress passed the COVID-19 relief package as part of a larger $2.3 trillion bill meant to cover spending for the rest of the fiscal year. As usual, U.S. representatives allocated a massive sum of money for the regime of Israel. While unemployment, thus poverty in the U.S., is skyrocketing as a result of repeated lockdowns, the U.S. found it essential to provide the Zionist regime with $3.3 billion in security assistance and $500 million for U.S.-Israeli regime missile cooperation. Although a meager $600 payment to help struggling American families was the subject of several months of intense debate, there was little discussion among American politicians over the large funds handed out to the Israeli regime for which there are no returns. Support for the fake regime of Israel is considered a bipartisan priority and has, for decades, been perceived as the most visible item in the U.S. foreign policy agenda. The mere questioning of how the Zionist regime uses the funds, whether the military aid is being actively used to sustain the regime's illegal occupation of Palestine, finance Jewish settlements, fund annexation of Palestinian land, or violate Palestinian human rights, is a major taboo. One of the few members of the U.S. Congress to demand that aid to the Israeli regime be conditioned on the latter's respect for human rights is Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who was also a leading presidential nominee for the Democratic Party. "We cannot give it carte blanche to the Israel. We have the right to demand respect for human rights and democracy," Sanders had said in October 2019. His Democratic rival, Joe Biden, soon countered, "The idea that I would withdraw military aid, as others have suggested, from Israel is bizarre," he said. It is no secret that the fake regime of Israel is the world's leading recipient of U.S. aid since the Second World War. According to data provided by the U.S. Congressional Research Service, the Israeli regime has received $146 billion of U.S. taxpayers' money as of November 2020. From 1971 up to 2007, a bulk of these funds proved fundamental in helping the Zionist regime establish a strong economic base. Since then, most of the money has been allotted for military purposes, including the security of Israeli regime's illegal Jewish settlement enterprise. Despite the U.S. financial crisis of 2008, American money continued to be channeled to the fake regime of Israel. In 2016, the U.S. promised even more money. The Democratic Barack Obama administration, which is often, although mistakenly, seen as hostile to the Israeli regime, increased U.S. funding to the Israeli regime by a significant margin. In a 10-year Memorandum of Understanding, Washington and Tel Aviv reached a deal whereby the U.S. agreed to give the Zionist regime $38 billion in military aid covering the financial years 2019 to 2028. This is a whopping increase of $8 billion compared with the previous 10-year agreement, which concluded at the end of 2018. The new American funds are divided into two categories, $33 billion in foreign military grants and an additional $5 billion in missile defense. American generosity has long been attributed to the unmatched influence of pro-Israeli groups, lead among them American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC. The last 4 years, however, required little lobbying by these groups, as powerful agents within the U.S. administration itself became Israeli regime's top advocates. Aside from the seemingly endless political freebies that Donald Trump administration has given the Zionist regime in recent years, it is now considering ways to accelerate the timetable of delivering the remainder of U.S. funds as determined by the last MOU, an amount that currently stands at $26.4 billion. According to official congressional documents, the U.S. also may approve additional sales of F-35 to the Israeli regime and accelerate the delivery of KC-46A refueling and transport aircraft to this regime. These are not all the funds and perks that Tel Aviv receives. Much more goes unreported, as it is channeled either indirectly or simply promoted under the flexible title of cooperation. For example, between 1973 and 1991, a massive sum of $460 million of U.S. funds was allocated to resettling Jews in the occupied Palestine. Many of these new immigrants are now the very Israeli terrorists that occupy the West Bank illegal settlements. In this particular case, the money is paid to a private charity known as the United Israel Appeal, which in turn gives the money to the Jewish Agency. The latter has played a central role in the founding of Israel on the top of the ruins of Palestinian towns and villages in 1948. Under the guise of charitable donations, tens of millions of dollars are regularly sent to the Israeli regime in the form of tax-deductible gifts for Jewish settlements in the West Bank and East Al-Quds. Much of the money, falsely promoted as donations for educational and religious purposes, often finds its way to funding and purchasing housing for illegal settlers, as well as guard dogs, bulletproof vests, rifle scopes, and vehicles to secure illegal Jewish outposts deep in occupied Palestinian areas. Quite often, U.S. money ends up in the Israeli regime's coffers under deceptive pretenses. For example, the latest stimulus package includes $50 million to fund the Nita M. Lowy West Asia Partnership for Peace Funds, supposedly to provide investments in people-to-people exchanges and economic cooperation between Israelis and Palestinians with the goal of supporting a negotiated and sustainable two-state solution. Actually, such money serves no particular purpose, since Washington and Tel Aviv endeavor to ensure the demise of a negotiated peace agreement and work hand-in-hand to kill the now defunct two-state solution. The list is endless, though most of this money is not included in the official U.S. aid packages to the regime of Israel. Therefore, receives little scrutiny, let alone media coverage. As of February 2019, the U.S. has withheld all funds to the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, in addition to cutting aid to the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency, UNRWA, the last lifeline of support needed to provide basic education and health services to millions of Palestinian refugees. Judging by its legacy of continued support of the Israeli military machine and the ongoing colonial expansion in the West Bank, Washington insists on serving as Israeli regime main benefactor, if not direct partner, while shunning Palestinians altogether. Expecting the U.S. to play a constructive role in achieving a just peace in Palestine does not only reflect indefensible naivety, but willful ignorance as well.